It's time for another episode of The Accidental Entrepreneur.
I figured who could help me figure out how to take a small New Jersey manufacturing company global. So I called the U.S. Department of Commerce in Washington, like I called the Department of Agriculture.
But everybody would right. do.
So I got somebody at the Commerce on the phone, and I told them, I said, we're a small manufacturing company in New Jersey with a small operation in Florida. I want to start to expand globally. I have no idea how to do that. Do you have any resources to help companies like ours do that? I said, yeah, we could probably help you. He said, where would you like to start? I said, I don't know, maybe Mexico, because it's relatively close.
This is like mid-80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
He said, well, here's the name of a person at our embassy, our commercial attaché officer in our embassy in Mexico City. Call him, explain what you're trying to do, and see if they can help you.
And you were looking for customers to do business right. outside the United States, right. where you would provide custom equipment that you would right. create, then ship it to them.
Right.
Right. So Mexico, you're thinking there's companies down there that need custom yeah. equipment?
Who knows? Just because it was close.
Right. There was, you didn't have to cross any water.
Right, right, okay. right. I could have gone to Canada.
Yeah, Canada maybe.
But I was already doing a little bit in Canada, so okay. I want to think outside the box.
Okay.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode. Hey, it's Mitch, your host. So thanks for joining me. This is the second part of our discussion with Jack Killian from Network All the Time. If you haven't listened to the first part, you really should go back because this is just a continuation of our discussion. Sit back and enjoy the rest of my two-hour discussion with Jack Killian. Learn about his history, his stories, and all of his advice about networking and growing your business.
So I'm thinking, I was down in Kentucky selling advertising for a country music.
You couldn't go to the bank and get a mortgage? You didn't get a loan?
I had nothing.
Oh, I guess you just took on debt. Millions of dollars of debt from your
right,
dad's business.
Right.
Okay.
So I was not bankable.
Right.
So I'm down in Kentucky selling advertising to the cigarette companies for a country music magazine. I've been racking my brain. I figured the only person that I can call, again, developing my networking skills.
Right.
I could maybe cold call the Secretary of Agriculture in Washington.
Secretary of Agriculture of the United States.
Right.
Okay.
So I asked the receptionist at Brown & Williams, could I use your phone? She said, sure. So I put in a call to the Secretary of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Right.
I didn't get him on the phone, but I got his assistant. I'm looking for some help from the Department of Agriculture. I've got 30 days to get enough money together to buy a farm.
Okay.
Otherwise, they're going to turn it into a housing development.
Was that true?
Yeah.
The buyer was going to put housing on the property.
Right.
Okay.
So I said, I'm sure the Department of Agriculture would prefer to keep 50 acres, prime acres in New Jersey as a farm, as opposed to just another housing development.
Okay.
Do you have any programs to help guys like me raise money to
That's smart.
Buy a farm?
Right.
So they didn't put me through to the secretary, but they put me through to one of his top assistants.
Okay.
And I told him the story again, and he said, yeah, we have programs. We have an office in New Jersey. I'll make a call to introduce you to the head of the office. Go up there, talk to them, see what they can do to help you.
Now, this just occurred to you, like maybe there's government programs
right,
out there?
Right, right.
Okay.
No previous knowledge of just racking
my
brain.
Took a shot. Okay.
Like we took a shot calling the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Right. Well, that at least you saw an article.
Yeah.
You know they were having trouble.
Took a shot.
Okay. Yeah, they could have told you we have no programs
right,
or whatever.
Right, right.
Okay.
When I got back from that sales trip, I called the office in New Jersey. I went up to meet them. They told me they had a couple programs where they could loan me money,
right.
even though I had this debt from the company.
Right, but they're not a bank. It's the government.
Yeah. And the land was going to be the asset for this deal. I didn't own the land when I did the deal with the bank.
Right.
So that was not part of the assets I was pledging to the bank.
Right.
For the company.
It wasn't encumbered. You didn't own it.
Right. So they said they could loan me, I forget, 75 or 80% of the money I needed.
Okay.
So I'm racking my brains. Where do I come up with the balance? Because I still don't have any money. And the only asset I had at the time was my equity ownership in Country Music Magazine.
Right, okay. You own 50%?
I own a third of 50%.
Oh, right, because the Star Tribune owned half.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Okay, so you own, that's third, so a sixth of
the
business.
Right,
okay.
So I called my friend, the chairman of the Minneapolis Star Tribune Company. I said, I'd like to make a proposal. He said, what's your proposal? I said, I want to sell you my share of Country Music Magazine for X dollars. And X dollars was the amount I was missing to buy the farm.
Right.
He said, why do you want to get out of country music? You're doing a great job. The company's being successful. And I said, because I told him the story. I said, I want to buy the farm. I have no other assets.
Tell him the story. Your dad had passed away. And took over the company and everything.
So I said, you know, the only asset I have is equity in Country Music Magazine. And he said, well, we don't want to lose you. You're doing a great job. And I said, you're not going to lose me. It's not going to change how I work. I'll still do what
and
I'm
you're
doing.
Still going to stay on with them, along with the horses, along with your dad's business.
Right.
Okay.
I said, but while we're talking about this, I said, me and Russell and Spencer should figure out a way to buy you out of country music because I'm going to be running around like crazy and I'm the guy that you're relying on to run it. So we should be thinking about an exit strategy for you. But in the meantime, I'd like to sell you my equity. He said, well, I don't think we want to do that. We, you know, you're involved with Harper's. You're doing a great job of both.
I thought Harper's was sold, not at that point.
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. He said, but I'll get back. Let me talk to some people here. But I don't think we're going to do this. So he called me the next day. He said, Jack, he said, we're not going to loan you. We're not going to buy you out. He said, but there's a check in the mail. It should be to you today. For what you need, we're going to loan it to you.
And so they gave you the money.
They gave me the money.
And they didn't want to buy yet. They wanted to keep skin in the game.
Right.
They
said, I'm going to put you in touch with our corporate attorney. You can work out a loan agreement between you and Judy and our company. But we don't want to lose you.
They didn't even want collateral.
They don't want to.
You were the collateral.
I was the collateral.
Okay, great.
So
they obviously liked you.
So that's how I got money to buy the farm.
Now that's not, is that where you live today?
Yeah.
In Tewksbury? It's the same land?
In Long Valley.
Long Valley.
We've been up there about 30 some odd years now.
Wow. And you told me recently that your son and his wife are moving there.
They're
and
buying.
You're going to live on the property?
Right. Our son and his wife are going to buy the farm. Because he loves the farm.
Is he going to do more with horses, bring more?
No.
He just likes being out there in the land?
They're going to buy it. We live in a several hundred year old German farmhouse. So we put a big addition on, put a garage up, office over the garage, a swimming pool. They've been
For you?
Okay. No, for him.
For him, okay.
And they've been remodeling an apartment in the barn, which is bigger than our current house.
Now, when we did a Zoom call the other day online, was that where you were sitting?
Yeah.
I could see that there were things open.
The beams.
They're already doing work there and stuff? Okay.
So
it's really going, now it's going to be third generation.
Right, third generation.
Wow.
So that sort of brings me round circle. I wound up, I made two decisions that other entrepreneurs might think about. Now I'm running Walnut Farm.
Okay.
I'm running Killian Extruders. I'm still running Harper's.
Right, and you're still involved in Country Music Magazine.
In Country Music Magazine. So I'm running four different businesses at once. And everyone deserved attention. I had to somehow be involved.
They needed your services, skills, your
intellect. I had to be at the farm feeding and doing things. I had to be at Killian Extruders, answering the phone, talking to customers.
Right.
Motivating the employees.
Right. And it wasn't like today where you have a cell phone if you're different places.
No.
People can still get all the
No cell phones.
None of that.
None of that.
Right.
No internet, no email, no nothing. It was letter, in person, or phone.
Right.
Landline.
You know, it's funny. To a certain extent, that might have helped you because the speed at which everything moved in those days, expectations were different.
Right.
So you didn't have people chasing you down saying, Jack, I got to talk to you now.
Right.
They would call your secretary. Your secretary would have to find you. They'd have to send you a letter. It was different. Okay.
Right, right.
But there's plenty of entrepreneurs that run multiple businesses.
Right, right. I made two decisions that I think were really critical to the success I was able to have. First one, I stopped drinking anything. And I was never a big alcohol drinker. Occasionally.
Right, you don't mean anything. You mean alcohol. Alcohol. You still drank water and nourished yourself.
No alcohol of any kind.
Out of your life.
Cold stop.
Okay.
Well, when I was in New York running the magazines, I'd be out at night.
Yeah, you have all these social events you had to go to, right?
But I realized I had to be absolutely clear-headed 24 hours a day, seven days a week.
Good advice.
And the other thing was I was out of shape, so I started jogging.
Okay.
And I realized I essentially felt like I had to turn myself into a weapon. I had to be absolutely...
Really sharp.
Really sharp, really fit.
Now, what year was this about?
Late 70s.
Okay, so fitness is starting to come on then also.
Yeah.
That was kind of coming into the
So I start jogging every day, and I got myself to... Now I don't jog, but I wish I did. But back then, I could jog any distance. If somebody told me, go jog to the George Washington Bridge, I could have done that. So I got myself really physically fit, mentally fit.
Okay.
And I was running four businesses at once.
Right. Well, it's hard to do all that stuff if you're not taking care of yourself.
Right. Right.
Which, to a certain extent, may have been one of your dad's problems he ran into.
Right. So I think all entrepreneurs
need
to think about managing their health as well as managing their business.
Yeah.
I think the two things are totally linked together.
Right.
So anyway, the way things evolved, we got Harper sold. So that eliminated one of the stress points.
Right.
I convinced Russell and Spencer. I tried to give Russell and Spencer, my two partners in country music, a piece of Killian Extruders.
Okay.
Because I was diverting my time, and they were not diverting their time. But they weren't interested in owning part of a privately held, small, struggling manufacturing company. So I got them to buy me out of Country Music Magazine.
And remember, the guy from Florida, what was his name?
Norm Brown.
So he owned 50% of the distribution company.
He owned 50%.
Okay.
So Russell and Spencer didn't want to come into the manufacturing company. They bought me out of Country Music with a note.
Okay.
And they continued to
run. Your 1/6 share.
My 1/6 share.
And how did the Star Tribune feel about that? They wanted you to be involved.
Before I did the deal with Russell and Spencer, we bought the Star Tribune out.
Ah, so you owned 100% of the business, the three of you, and then they bought you out.
And we bought the Star and Tribune company out, and it was only after a couple of years of their being an investor, where they made a nice substantial gain on their investment. So our phone call to them to turn around Harper's and get them involved in a startup really worked for them. They sold Harper's, and they got a return on return on their investment in country music.
So Russell, and what was your other partner's name?
Spencer.
So Russell and Spencer went off.
And continued to run
Country Music Magazine. Okay. Harper's is now gone.
Harper's is gone. So now I'm running Killian Extruders.
Yeah, the horses.
And the horses.
Okay.
And early on with the horse business, I had other people training whatever horses we had at the track.
Okay.
But that was not being successful. So one day I said to Judy, if we're going to stay in the horse business, I think we have to totally integrate. We have to breed our own. I think we have to train our own.
So when you say train, you train them for racing and then sell the horses?
No.
Or they're racing for your farm?
Racing for our farm at the track.
Okay.
So, which meant either me or Judy every day would have to be at the racetrack.
And you win money out of a purse if the horse places.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I still live on a farm, so I spent 20 years breeding and training racehorses. Became pretty successful in the horse racing industry. I was elected president of the group in New Jersey that represents all the owners in the state. So I was the guy that was negotiating purses with the tracks.
So you only did racehorses. You didn't do equine jumpers.
No, I only did thoroughbred racehorses.
Okay.
And when we
Lana Lobel Farms, right? They were racehorses.
They were trotters.
Trotters. Okay.
We were thoroughbreds.
Okay.
We spent 20 years breeding and training racehorses. Again, most of my entrepreneurial career has been bootstrapping companies. I never had a big financial backing. Because, again, I learned that you don't need much money to start and grow companies.
Money gets people in trouble.
Right. When we decided to start breeding our own, I start networking within the horse racing industry. So one of the things about networking is whatever business you're in at the time, you got to really develop an in-depth network.
In that industry.
In that industry. So in country music, I developed a network with artists and artist managers and radio stations and record companies.
Sure, you need that for content, for advertising, the whole thing.
And in the manufacturing companies with plastic companies and suppliers and industry associations and magazines.
Right, you want to be tied into what's going on in the industry, right?
I developed a robust network in the horse racing industry. We're looking for a female horse to buy to breed to be our foundation.
You had all males? Was it stallions?
Mostly males, but we didn't really have a good female.
Okay.
So I looked around. It took me a year to find one out of Belmont that was available for $1,500 from a prominent racing family. So I went out and looked, and it was a three-year-old who had been injured. She had never run, would never run. The family and her mother had never really produced anything. So she essentially had very limited value. I looked at her. I looked at her bloodlines. I liked what I saw. I could see why she had had physical problems. But for $1,500, we weren't going to do much better. So we bought her for $1,500.
And it wasn't like the kind of physical stuff that was going to pass on to...
But I was hoping I could find stallions that would overcome that.
Okay.
So we bought her for $1,500. And then I spent some time looking for an inexpensive stallion. I found one down in Maryland that we could breed to for $1,000. So we had a $1,500 female bred to a male for $1,000.
And you don't buy the stallion. It's a stud fee.
Just for servicing the mare.
He impregnates your horse and you pay him $1,000. Right. Thank you very much. Right. Okay.
So that was the first baby horse that we raised, that we delivered, raised, and the first baby horse that I ever trained off of Walnut Farm. And in her first year of running, she was ranked one of the top 10 females in America.
So she was making money.
She was making money.
Okay.
And the mother that we bought for $1,500 turned out to be a half-sister to Secretariat.
Really?
He was born...
How'd you figure that out?
He was born after her from the same mother.
I see. Okay.
So he was born 3 or 4 years down the road after our film.
Does that increase her value?
I eventually sold her for $250,000.
Wow. The one that you paid $1,500 for.
Right.
Unbelievable.
So again,
crazy business.
If you want to be successful as an entrepreneur, you have to really get in depth in your industry.
Right.
When Judy and I looked at going into that business, I said there's three parts to the business. First of all, the bloodline, so we're not going to have enough money to compete with the wealthiest people in the world, getting to the best stallions. So we're going to have to be very creative in finding females and finding males to put together.
Right.
I said, so they have an advantage in the breeding end. We have our own farm, so I think we can raise horses just as good as anybody else because we can buy the same feed. We can find a good vet, a good blacksmith.
Right.
So I think it's neutral raising the horse from birth to when they get to the track. And I said, at the track, I'm just egotistical enough to think I'm going to have an edge over most of these trainers.
Right.
I think I'm smarter than the average racehorse trainer. Sure. So I think we're going to have an edge with me training our own horses. And that turned out to be the true
and
equation.
And you never trained a horse
before. I'd never trained a horse.
Wow.
So that turned out to be the true equation.
Okay. And what about your dad's business? What happened to his business?
I continued to run that for 10 years.
Okay. Late 80s.
Turned it into a pretty successful company from a regional 12 or 13 person company to an international company with over 125 employees, 3 locations.
Wow, so you do business all over the world.
All over the world.
Okay.
But that's a whole interesting story how I did that. Very early on, I knew that the world was going global. That we had to have a global presence. This is way before people talk about globalization.
Right, sure.
So my wife had worked for a small software company, and one of their sales guys was really a terrific guy. And the software company was struggling, so I hired Don Miller to join Killian Extruders as the first salesperson the company ever had.
But he was in the software sales business? He was a salesman.
Yeah. Knew nothing about the plastic industry or
when you're
equipment.
A salesman, it doesn't matter if you're a good salesman.
So after he had been with us a couple of years and the company had been stabilized, I took him out one night for dinner and I said, Don, we've got to go international. And I said, so I think you should become VP of International Sales for Killian Extruders and figure out how to do this.
And he had only done stuff in the United States,
right? And he said, I wouldn't have the first idea of where to start. I said, me either.
Okay.
I said, but I think you should devote your time to figuring out how to start. Don started to look at trying to do things internationally. And again, I made a strategic cold call. Again, part of this networking skill that I developed. I figured who could help me figure out how to take a small New Jersey manufacturing company global. So I called the U.S. Department of Commerce in Washington. Like I called the Department of agriculture.
But everybody would do.
So I got somebody at the Commerce on the phone, and I told them, I said, we're a small manufacturing company in New Jersey with a small operation in Florida. I want to start to expand globally. I have no idea how to do that. Do you have any resources to help companies like ours do that? I said, yeah, we could probably help you. He said, where would you like to start? I said, I don't know, maybe Mexico, because it's relatively close.
This is like mid-80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
He said, well, here's the name of a person at our embassy, our commercial attaché officer in our embassy in Mexico City. Call him, explain what you're trying to do, and see if they can help you.
And you were looking for customers to do business outside the United States, where you would provide custom equipment that you would create, then ship it to them.
Right.
Right. So Mexico, you're thinking there's companies down there that need custom equipment?
Well,
who knows?
Just because it was close.
Right. There was, you didn't have to cross any water.
Right, right, okay. Right. I could have gone to Canada.
Yeah, Canada maybe.
But I was already doing a little bit in Canada, so I want to think outside the box.
Okay.
So I called this guy and I got him on the phone, and he said, what would you like to do? And one of my philosophies as an entrepreneur, in every business I've been in, I like to create events to get potential customers coming to me. And I've done it in every industry. I did it at country music and publishing. I put on publishing events as joint ventures with NYU. I did it in the horse racing industry, where I put together events to attract new owners into the racing industry. So at Killian Extruders, I wanted to create events. So I told the people in Mexico at the embassy that I'd like to create a one-day event to talk about the American polymer processing technologies, positioned as experts from America coming down to share their knowledge. But I didn't have any contacts. I didn't know how to reach the plastic industry in Mexico. Could they help me? So we put together a deal where the embassy helped promote the event that we would
put on. This was going to be in Mexico?
In Mexico City, at the embassy.
At the embassy, okay.
They were going to host the event, pay for the food, pay to have simultaneous translations, and help spread the word in Mexico's plastic industry about the event. So we wound up with about 150 people coming to the embassy.
Wow.
To hear me and two guys from Killian Extruders essentially talk about what we're doing. Because we were on the early stage, cutting edge of things, because we were building custom equipment.
Right.
That really worked.
You know, sometimes it's not how big or small you are, it's how big or small your thinking is.
Right, totally.
You are a small company, but you're thinking big. They don't know.
They have no idea.
You're a company from the United States. You must be big.
Right, right.
It's irrelevant.
And we're positioning ourselves through the embassy as experts.
Right.
As industry experts.
Yeah.
We wound up selling quite a bit of equipment into Mexico, but then we repeated the process throughout Latin America. So I did the same thing in Venezuela. So when I hear all the problems going on in Venezuela, I've been there. I can visualize that.
Right.
We did it in Uruguay. We did it in Bogota, Colombia. Did it in Panama City. And over a period of a few years, we started developing a really robust business.
So South America and Central America.
Central America and South America.
Right.
And in the process, we wound up taking on a couple of independent sales reps in these markets. Yeah. So now we're starting to build an international sales organization. In the meantime, as the company grew, we outgrew the space that we originally
had. In Verona. Did you own that building? We owned the building.
We eventually sold the building, rented a much larger space in Cedar Grove, 25,000 square foot space.
A big facility.
Big facility where we had a nice conference room. They came up with the concept of putting together 1 week polymer processing workshops in New Jersey that we would conduct in Spanish by getting guys who worked in our factory who were Hispanic.
Right.
So they would come in and run. We'd do all of our slides in Spanish.
So you'd fly, these executives or whatever would fly in for a week?
They would fly in for a week.
With your company from Mexico or South America?
Right. And we would charge them $1,000 a person for the week.
Right.
And we could accommodate about 20 people in a week. So we were grossing $20,000 a week. In fees,
very low cost.
Very low cost lunches. Right. They would pay their own airfare and hotel.
Right.
They became our sales force when they went back into their companies. They had spent a week with us. They knew our people.
Right.
They knew we could do business fluently in Spanish.
You spoke the language.
So that became a strategy that we used in other parts of the world.
Okay.
So after 10 years of running the company, I got approached by a British company, public British company. They were looking to have a presence in the U.S. They were in the plastic industry. I had never really intended to be in the plastic manufacturing equipment business. My partner was about 15 years older than me. He was ready to bag it and retire.
Norm, the guy from Florida.
Norm, the guy from Florida.
Right.
It made sense for us to sell the company.
Okay.
So we sold the company to this British company. We both got a 3-year employment contract to continue running the business.
Right.
I took a lot of the strategies that I used to grow Killian Extruders over to the British company. I went on the board of the British company. My partner did not, but I went on the board of the British
parent
company.
Parent company. Okay.
We did 10 high-tech acquisitions in 3 years in 3 different categories. In the plastic industry was one category. Specialty industrial furnaces was another category. And specialty instrumentation was the 3rd category.
They're a big manufacturing conglomerate.
They're a big conglomerate. Hot shot stock on the London Exchange.
Okay.
I really had an impact on the company.
So this was like late 80s going into the 90s.
90s.
Okay.
One of the lessons I learned at Country Music Magazine that I now have applied in every entrepreneurial venture I've been in, you have to have multiple revenue streams. So like back in the country music days, in addition to getting income from selling copies of the magazine and advertising, we start publishing books. I probably published 40 books and sell the books through the magazine. We created a weekly syndicated newspaper column through King Features. So we got money from writing a weekly column. We partnered with Suzuki Motorcycles to do a once a week, 1 hour country music magazine of the year radio show that we syndicated on over 200 stations. We evolved into being pretty big in direct mail marketing and wound up producing our own records and tapes that we sold on television. With country music, we had 7 or 8 different revenue streams.
You know, I think that's really, really good advice for people because, you know, there's one thing that you and I both know, and that's things always change. They never stay the same. They change because of things that are in your control. They change because of things that are outside your control. And there's no business that's ever been successful selling one thing or doing one thing. If they're successful, they've evolved. Maybe they've stopped doing one thing, started doing another thing. And I think that the business owners that are successful, like you know and I know, that's exactly what they do. They grow their business. Not just in terms of sales and one thing they do, with those different lines of business.
Right.
And it protects them against economic changes and global changes and all that type of stuff. That's really good advice for people.
Right. With Killian Extruders, for example, first of all, I decided Killian Extruders' business model was not correct. My father had started and grown the company based on being an equipment manufacturing company. That's what he did, a custom equipment manufacturing company.
Yeah, they made the equipment that the plastics industry used.
Right.
And that's all they did.
Right.
That was their one line of business.
Right. And I thought that we didn't really have a big competitive edge, particularly with my father gone and his knowledge gone, because other competitors could buy similar components and put them together. So I thought we should really reinvent ourselves as a polymer processing problem solver. So once
almost
I started.
Almost like a consultant, right?
Yeah, you know, like a consultant. So I needed multiple revenue streams.
Right.
So the first thing I started doing was these programs in other countries, and eventually these workshops in New Jersey were generating $20,000 at a clip. So I started viewing education as a revenue stream.
Right.
And I started running conferences.
So both educated people and sold what you did.
Right.
Right.
Sold
same
what
time.
We did.
And
so,
didn't do it for free, which is I think is important.
Right. I also started doing 2-day conferences in America on different polymer processing topics where I would charge people $300-$500 to come to the conference and get 100 or 200 people coming to an event.
Now, you're not an expert on polymer processing.
No.
You brought the experts in to speak, right?
Right, right, okay. Right.
Were they people that worked for the company or not necessarily?
Some are company, but to give it credibility, I'd get speakers from prominent companies,
right.
From DuPont or Monsanto or J&J. So when we sent out the invitations, it wasn't just from Killian Extruders, those Killian Extruders and co-sponsors,
right.
Those companies.
And they get PR out of it.
They get PR. They get
exposure.
They get exposure. They're talking to a couple hundred people.
Right. Works for everybody.
And then when my dad still owned the company, companies would call us and ask if they could come in and use our equipment to do some testing that they were working on before they bought our equipment.
Yeah.
So they were consuming a lot of manpower on our part. Sort of see whether they could buy equipment from us.
Right.
So I decided to open a separate company called Killian Extruder Development, which was going to be a laboratory that companies could pay to use to do trial runs, test new products, new resins. So we opened that in New Jersey. I put it at another location so there'd be no confusion. So when potential customers call and ask if they could use our equipment, I could say, yes, we have a separate development company. Call Keith Luker, the head of it. He'll be happy to work with you. So the labs became a revenue stream, and I eventually opened labs in New Jersey, Florida, and California as a separate company. So we were doing conferences.
And you owned 100% of that company.
Owned 100% of that company. And if I had stayed with Killing Extruders and not sold it, I think I would have taken it into the publishing business. I think I would have started a polymer processing magazine to take advantage of my magazine.
Right, like a trade magazine.
Like a trade magazine.
Yeah.
As entrepreneurs, you need to be constantly thinking about how to diversify what you're offering. Because as Mitch says, things change. You got to be ahead of the curve.
Right, absolutely.
Going back to the sale of Killing Extruders, after 3 years, I got a call that Thermal Scientific had been, that was the name of the buyer, Thermal Scientific had been approached about selling the whole company. They wanted me in London for the weekend to meet with the buyer and negotiate the deal because I was on the board.
So at that point, they had bought Killing Extruders. You were on the board. You helped them acquire, you said, 3 or 4 companies.
10 companies.
Now they got a buyer of the whole business.
Of the whole business.
Okay. It's a public company, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, public company.
Okay.
That's after my 3 years with them.
So after, you'd already finished the 3-year contract. You weren't with them anymore. You were just on the board.
Right on the board. I was right at the end of finishing my 3-year period. So I flew over on a weekend. We met at Barclays Bank. We spent the weekend. We even slept in the facilities. Monday morning, we announced the sale of Thermal Scientific to a much larger multi-billion-dollar British tech company. So then I'm off on my own.
I
made money on the deal.
Because you had stock in it.
Because when I sold Killing Extruders to Thermal Scientific, I sold it part cash and part stock. And the stock went up significantly during the 3-year period I was there.
And then it's going to go up again.
I was out looking for new things to do.
So you walk away, you got a pile of cash now, you have no businesses anymore. What happened to the laboratory business?
That all sold with
Killing. That was all part of the sale.
That was all part of the sale.
So you've now disgorged yourself of all the businesses you were running, and you're basically, now you're really an entrepreneur looking for something to do.
Yeah, plus I'm still in the horse business.
Right, you have the farm and the horses, right?
Yeah, and I'm still doing that.
Right,
I'm still
for years until recently, right?
Yeah.
Several years ago.
Back then, I still had to be at the racetrack every morning, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
And then you go off to whatever you were doing at the time. So, a lot of energy, Jack.
Right, still do. Knock on wood.
Right.
I was looking around, again, using my networking skills. And I think if you're an entrepreneur, and one of the things I do now is I coach people how to network, including entrepreneurs, I recommend that you have at least 7 in-person meetings a week. Deliberate, targeted networking meetings a week. That'll probably take you 10 or 11 hours to do. And I think you have to devote that amount of time to creating new ideas, new alliances, new situations. So I start networking with people. And I ran across a very bright guy who I'd worked with at McKinsey, Victor Schnee, who owned a company, a research company in the telecom space called Probe Research. Probe Research was doing work for major telecom companies like AT&T, the Bell companies.
Right.
And Victor, way ahead of his time, had an idea to start a new magazine for the corporate user to educate them about the new mobile and wireless communication technologies that were evolving.
So just starting then, right? The mobile phone was just coming on.
Just coming on.
Right.
We were probably 6 or 7 years ahead of our time. But he asked me if I wanted to team up with him to start a magazine for that sector. So I said, yeah, but Victor was a really tough guy. He's really a brilliant guy. One of the things I learned is I don't necessarily want to own a part of most small companies because most of them never really get bought out.
Right.
You're kidding yourself you think you're going to monetize the equity. And I didn't want to be his employee. I didn't want to have that kind of role. So I proposed that I work full-time on launching a magazine, but as an independent paid consultant. So we negotiated a fee for me to do that. So I helped Victor launch Wireless for the Corporate User magazine. And I was the only person in the very early stages working on the magazine. And again, I knew nothing about the industry.
No, but you knew the publishing.
I knew the publishing business, but I knew nothing about the telecom industry. So again, I had to create a whole new network among all these companies like AT&T and Verizon. And
learn the industry, to have the experts, to bring in the content, to get the advertisers, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
but it's really the same formula that you had used in many industries. That's why I think networking and what you do and your experience is really valuable to people because It shows people that it doesn't matter what you do. The networking, the formula is the same, and it works if you are relentless and stay after people and do the same thing over and over.
Right.
You're just repeating yourself.
Right. The biggest challenge I had in that business was just understanding the language of the business.
Right. It was more technical than the other stuff you had done.
And it's all acronyms. Like, it took me months to understand what an RBOC was.
Okay.
I kept asking, what's an RBOC? RBOC means Regional Bell Operating Company. It was a company that spun off from the
AT&T. It was an acronym for a baby bell, basically.
Yeah.
But you had been in the extrusion business. I'm sure you didn't know anything about polymers either, and you got to know that lingo.
No. So whatever business you're in, you really have to devote yourself to understanding the business.
Right.
So I essentially turned myself into an expert in that industry.
Right.
In the magazine, I stayed with Victor with the project for 4 or 5 years. And we were really early, but we turned that into a very successful venture. Again, multiple revenue streams. So one of the things, because the industry was...
Because most publications make their money from advertising,
right?
Okay,
right.
So what are the other revenue streams you developed?
There, because we're essentially helping to create a new industry, and the corporate user of these technologies didn't really understand them.
Right, and that's really who was using it in the early days, right?
Yeah.
Corporate guys.
Yeah. So I developed a program, I called it Executive Briefings. So we start running half-day executive briefings around the country and eventually in other countries.
They're half-day seminars.
Half-day
seminars.
You can go and
learn about the technology.
Right. Where we would let the end user come for free. We would have these at a hotel or university. The end user would come for free, the attendees.
Right.
And we could pack a room because the information was really critically important. And we would fund that by selling sponsorships to companies to speak at the events.
They want to get in front of these people.
Right. So we were,
and they had the money.
They had the money.
Right.
So we had no problem selling out executive briefings. And we would do typically 8 or 10 a year. And the best markets turned out to be Dallas, Chicago, and New York. The California markets were not good. Boston was good. We did a one-day full briefing specifically targeting the healthcare industry because these technologies were applicable for that.
So you're saying the user base that was developing was more Dallas, Chicago, New York, not so much on the West Coast.
Right. But we also tried Miami, Atlanta, Detroit.
Wasn't as successful?
No, but they made money. But but the real home runs.
We do
one in New York, we get 700 people coming.
Wow.
We'd have to break it up and do two half-day programs.
Right.
And then we started publishing annual guides. So we would do an annual buyer's guide for wireless mobile communications.
And like the consumer reports for the executives that reviewed this equipment?
Right.
Okay.
So the guides were aimed at the end user, the corporate buyer.
Right.
But all the content came from the suppliers. So they would run a page of advertising. Maybe we'd give them 2 pages of editorial content.
Right.
So we could do an annual guide that grossed $350,000.
So it wasn't a review of this. You weren't testing the equipment.
No.
You were saying, okay, we have this.
This
forum.
Is what this is.
People come in and say, this is what we offer.
This is what
and
we
then
have.
People could read about it because it wasn't like the internet nowadays where you can search anything.
No.
You needed content.
Right.
You needed
it was like the showcase of technology.
Right. Okay. That
so
makes sense.
So we had these annual guides. We had these briefings, and we started doing conferences. So I did a 2-day wireless and mobile communication conference in Amsterdam, for example, using European suppliers as the sponsors. So again, multiple revenue streams. I was seeing all these exciting young companies that were developing these new technologies. So I decided to take part of the editorial direction of the magazine in the direction of talking about these companies as investment vehicles.
For people to invest in telecom.
For people to invest in telecom.
Were they public companies a lot?
Yeah, a lot of them were small public companies. Back then it was the dot-com boom.
Right.
Things were starting to
heat up. For the average investor, you can buy stock.
Right.
Okay.
To kick off that part of the magazine, I organized an event at the Yale Club in New York. Again, networking.
Right.
I called all the major Wall Street houses.
Yale's over like a block and a half from Grand Central, isn't it? Right near the Cornell Club.
On Vanderbilt Avenue.
Okay, right.
So I called all the major Wall Street houses. I talked to them about who was their telecom analyst. And I put together a luncheon at the Yale Club with about 20 wireless and mobile communication analysts.
Analysts mean guys in the investment business that were analyzing these companies.
Right.
Okay.
So we put together like a 12-page section in the next issue of the magazine where we summarized the views of these analysts on What are the technologies that are going to emerge because there's competing technologies? What are some of the early stage companies that they like?
Right.
And that really started a whole different editorial
trend. Yeah, I think regulatory compliance in those days was a little bit looser than it is now. It's probably a little bit easier to get that content.
So then we started doing investor conferences in the technology space. Along the way, I met a woman from one of the major Wall Street firms. I went out to dinner with her, told her what I was doing. And she said, why don't we start a hedge fund to invest in these companies?
Right.
I didn't even know what a hedge fund was.
Yeah, that was the early days of hedge funds.
So we talked for maybe 5 or 6 months, and we decided to start a hedge fund to invest in the technology sector, communication sector.
Right.
So we called that fund the Information and Communication Technology Fund. Meanwhile, I decided to get out of the publishing with wireless for the corporate user and to go into the hedge fund business.
So you sold out.
I had built up a management team, which continued after I left.
Okay.
And eventually he sold the magazine.
Did you own part of that magazine? Or you no, just an employee?
Just an employee. Just an independent fee-paid consultant.
Okay.
I got a piece of the revenue stream plus a fee.
Right. Okay.
We started this Information and Communication Technology Fund. It's really sort of the only partnership that I've had that didn't work the right way. And I learned some lessons. Putting together a partnership is, you really have to be careful.
You really got to set the rules up right so you don't, because we got more partners getting in trouble. They're not happy with the relationship. They can't change it. It's difficult.
I picked the wrong partner in this situation.
Right. Well, she kind of found you, didn't she?
Cause she found me. I was the access to the content.
Right.
She was a very well-established advisor at a major firm with a high-level position. I quit Wireless for the Corporate User magazine to do this. Her husband was a doctor in New Jersey. He had an office behind his practice. So we set the fund up in this office behind her husband's medical practice.
Right.
And then she never quits her job on Wall Street.
Unbeknownst to you, or you knew that?
I didn't know that.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know that.
Right.
So by the time I quit my job to go into partnership with her, she's going to work on it like she was full-time.
Right.
But in name, she's not going to give up her job at the Wall Street firm and her clients at that firm. She puts her husband in as her surrogate partner with me. So now I'm partners with the husband doctor who has no interest or cares.
Right. Yeah, because she couldn't own it with you without disclosing it to her company in New
York City. Meanwhile, she had been running her business for the Wall Street firm out of the same office space.
Okay.
So from her firm's point of view, there was no apparent difference.
They didn't know anything.
They didn't know anything.
Right.
I should have walked away, but I didn't do that.
No, you got to be all in, right?
Yeah. She would work there, but, you know, half the phone calls would be for her parent company.
Right.
And half the phone calls would be for our new company.
Right.
For our new fund.
Right.
We started just when the dot-com thing really took off. We started with capital from just, I think, four of us. I think we started with $600,000 from four investors, me, her, and two friends. By the second year, we were on the cover of Barron's magazine.
And did you bring in other investors?
Yeah.
Or just at that point, you were...
She was great in a rising market. She knew how to leverage capital.
Right.
And she was brilliant. She's one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. And she was brilliant in a rising market. Our performance just took off like crazy.
Right.
I think in the second year, we're the second highest performing hedge fund in the country.
Oh,
even though we were small, but we started to attract capital from other countries. Then the market turned and it started to go down. It corrected.
Right.
And I kept trying to convince her.
Like some dot-coms were blowing up and it was changing the business.
And one of the lessons I learned is that there are good money managers in rising markets and there are good money managers in declining
it's
markets.
It's a different skill, isn't it?
It's a different skill and different mindset.
Yeah.
Because in a rising
bulls
market.
Bulls and bears, kind of.
Yeah, bulls and bears.
Right.
She was great in the rising market.
Right.
Not good in a declining market.
A different way to make money in a declining market.
Right.
Right.
So I kept trying to get us to go to cash until things calmed down. And she kept thinking every week was the bottom of the market and she kept chasing it. So we wound up losing 80% of the money.
Right. After you were that big, right?
After we were that big. It was pretty discouraging. Our investors were discouraged. Some of them pulled out. Many of them didn't. So one of the things that surprised me is the resilience of investors.
Yeah.
They just won't change. So at the end of our third year, this wasn't working. And she wanted to totally change the mandate of the fund. She said, I was never a technology expert. I'm a more balanced portfolio manager. We got to roll the money into a new fund, different mandate. And I didn't want to do that.
Right.
I didn't see anything I could bring to that equation. So we contacted all the investors. Most of them rolled money over into a new fund that she created, and I left. And one of the guys that was working with us said to me, why don't we start a fund of hedge funds? He had been like a staff guy at the technology fund.
Right, that's where the Eagle Rock fund
that's
came
where,
from.
So the two of us started the Eagle Rock Diversified Fund to invest in a portfolio of hedge funds. I thought this guy was going to be a great partner. So I made a mistake with a woman as a partner. I thought this guy was going to be a great partner. He looked the part. He's like 6'2", good looking, well dressed, authoritative, had a good college education, naval officer, worked for a major retail company, had his own retail business for a while. On paper, he looked like the real deal. The first time I thought we were going to have a problem was when I met his wife. She was totally not up to speed with what we were doing.
Had no clue.
She had no clue. She had nothing she could really add to the equation. It was obvious she was going to be an anchor on him. He was not going to be able to spend the kind of crazy time I spend out meeting people, developing relationships.
Right. So it wasn't like he had another job, but in terms of like going to a night event or a morning breakfast, she'd be like, how come you're not home?
Right.
There's a supportive side of the relationship.
So for other entrepreneurs, when you're looking for a partner, when you're thinking about a partnership, I recommend you spend some time with a partner's, potential partner's spouse.
Right.
Male or female.
Right.
You'll learn a ton.
A lot of the dynamics.
You'll learn a ton doing that.
But the Eagle Rock Fund was successful.
Right. I just ended it in December. Right. For 18 years, Eagle Rock Fund.
But he left early on, though.
He left after a couple of years.
Okay.
Because in the first couple of years, we were working pretty hard, trying to raise capital and find funds to invest in. And he just wasn't having the impact that he should have had. And I really liked the guy. So I said to him, you know, there's some reason why you're not being successful. I have no idea what it is. And I even had people tell me, you know, there's no sense you sending him out to meet with me because he doesn't like spending time with people.
Oh, well, and, you're not a people person.
And but he appeared to be a people.
Appeared to be.
I had never realized that. So I suggested he go see somebody who could counsel him. So he wound up going to a doctor, psychological thing.
Oh, for therapy.
For therapy.
Okay.
One day he shows up in my house with boxes of stuff. I said, what are all the boxes? He says, it's all my files. He said, I can't work any longer. I said, what do you mean you can't work any longer? He said, my doctor says I'm under too much stress.
Not just for you, but just in general, he couldn't work.
In the meantime, his mother had passed away and left him some money.
Okay, so he has the money.
So he had a little cushion. He had cushion. So I said, you can't just walk away.
Right.
I said, everybody's under stress. Everybody has to work.
Life.
He said, my doctor really recommends that I not work. So I said, we can't just have you walk out. We got investors who put money in. I said, why don't I just continue to run the fund? You don't have to come in. You get straightened out. And when she says you're okay, come back in and we'll pick up again.
Right.
In the meantime, I'll run it.
Right. Well, it's been 18 years. He never came back.
Right. So we did that for a year.
Okay.
I paid him the same as I was getting paid.
Oh, okay.
I would meet with him once a month to sign checks.
Right.
Because we had co-signatures.
Okay.
I'd meet him in a diner, and I'd bring him up to date. Some of our investors would say, I never hear from Kirk. What's good?
Right.
So I had to fudge what Kirk was doing. So after a year, I knew this wasn't going to work. So on one of our meetings at the diner, I took 2 one-page documents that I had drafted. And I said, Kirk, this is not going to work any longer. Here's 2 agreements. You can sign either one you want. One you sign, you own the fund, you're running it, starting today.
And buy you out.
I'll walk away. The other one.
You had money in the fund. Though,
I
right?
had money as an investor.
So an investor, but you wouldn't run the fund.
Right. Okay. The other agreement is you get out of the fund. I'll continue to run the fund. And I've signed them both.
But no money changing hands.
No money changing hands.
You can either take it or you'll take it.
Right.
Okay.
I don't care which one you do.
Right. Okay.
I said, but we got to resolve it today. He signed the one where he walked away.
Okay.
And probably
what you expected him to do, right?
I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure. I was hoping he was saying, let's not do either.
Right. I want to stay in this.
I'm ready to come back to work.
Right. That didn't happen.
But it didn't happen. And from my point of view, the bad thing that happened is several of the early stage investors were his relatives. So when he pulled out,
they pulled out.
So I continued to run the fund for 18 years of my own.
Right.
And I just stopped at the end of last year because I'm getting older. And some of our investors were getting older and having to reclaim their money. And I've also got some health issues. And I didn't feel comfortable going out raising new money from new investors when I've got...
Don't have anybody really wants to take it over, run the fund or anything like that.
Yeah.
So what did you do? You disbanded the fund, sent checks back to everybody, and that's it?
At the end of 18, I sent checks back to everybody. In the meantime, I've been doing a couple of other things.
Yeah, so let's get into that. Because we've been talking for like 2 hours. We probably could go for another hour, but I want to get into what all the stuff you're doing now.
I'm interested in education.
You've always been interested.
Yeah, I've taught at 3 colleges, Rutgers, Montclair State, and Fairleigh Dickinson University.
You still teach there, don't you?
No, but I'm still involved.
Okay.
I still recruit for MIT. I run a networking group of graduates at the MIT Business School. In fact, we had one of our periodic dinner meetings last night.
So like an alumni group locally for Sloan School graduates.
Right. Okay. It's very successful formula. Okay. MIT thinks it's about the most successful alumni program that they have going on. So we're talking about me helping them expand it worldwide. So for about the last 4 or 5 years, my wife also is an entrepreneur. And she had a magazine for professional corporate women in New Jersey. And she also has a foundation to empower women and younger women in the state. It's called the Garden State Women Education Foundation.
Yeah, wasn't it Garden State Women's Magazine?
Yeah.
Magazine?
Yeah.
Right. Is it still around? Is it a website now?
No, it's a website and events.
Okay.
With the emphasis on the foundation. Early on, the foundation was providing scholarship support for inner city high school girls going to 4-year New Jersey colleges. Again, multiple revenue streams. When Judy had the magazine, she would also do events, financial conferences for women, health conferences for women. I started doing half-day networking workshops for professional and corporate women.
Okay.
And we would charge them to come. I would be the freebie speaker for Judy. And we might get 50 to 75 women coming at a time. Lawyers, accountants, bankers, business owners. And I did a few of those. And I got a call one day from an accounting firm, Rothstein Cass.
Sure.
Asking me if I could put together a program to teach their women professionals how to network and develop client relationships. So from doing these little workshops for Judy, I wound up doing 2 years' worth of coaching with Rothstein Cass.
Now, are they still around? They get acquired?
They were still around.
They acquired other firms?
No, they got acquired by KPMG.
Ah, okay.
Until they got acquired, I was doing $30,000 to $40,000 a year of coaching with Rothstein Cass, initially with the women. And eventually it morphed into both men and women because the men heard about the program and they wanted to come in. So that got me into having an interest in coaching people how to network and develop relationships as a way to do 4 things. Just impact their personal lives, because the better you get at this, the more opportunities you create personally. Impact your family, because the opportunities I've created for Judy and our son Jonathan through my networking are unbelievable.
Right.
Jonathan's only had 2 jobs out of college. He's been out 14 years. I networked him to both jobs. He's never looked for a job.
Right.
And he's doing great.
Yeah, jumping all over the place. He's had 2 jobs.
So personally, you benefit, your family benefits, the organization you're working with benefits, and your career benefits. I now am spending a fair amount of time coaching people on how to develop these skills. I've been running workshops for people, in-person workshops. The largest group, I did 200 lawyers at Brooklyn Law School. I've been brought in by companies like Colgate Palmolive, JP Morgan Chase, Signature Bank. I've coached at maybe 8 or 9 universities, RPI, Drew, Rutgers, Fordham.
And it's really not a skill that's taught. Look, as a lawyer, and Harris Rothstein, real visionary in the accounting space, built a big firm. Most professionals do not know how to network. They go to their alumni events, and they don't know what to do.
They have no idea.
They have no idea to follow up and to call people and build networks and stay in touch and all the stuff that we do on a regular basis.
So I've really turned myself modestly into a real networking expert. I've written a book on the topic. The book is called Network All the Time, Everywhere, with Everybody. That's my philosophy, and it's on Amazon, both in print and Kindle.
That was your first publication.
Right? My
first publication. You're working on a second. Now, Network All the Time is also your website?
Yeah.
So, networkallthetime.com, if they want to learn about you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll put links in the show notes to the book.
That'd be great.
Website and all that type of stuff.
That'd be great. One of the recent programs I've developed to coach people is using Zoom, which is like Skype.
Right. It's a video conferencing platform, right?
Right.
Okay.
So I'm now completing my second program, and the program consists of 4 1-hour sessions, once a week for 4 weeks in a row, where I bring in groups of people from different locations,
okay.
Or they could be from the same location, but the two groups I've run so far are from multiple states, multiple companies.
Right, but it's done remotely.
It's done
through
remotely.
The computer. Okay.
Where everybody jumps on the computer.
Right.
The current program is Fridays from noon to 1 o'clock.
It's a one-month program.
It's a one-month program for an hour once a week. The first one I think I did on Tuesdays. This one I'm doing on Fridays.
And where do you find these people? Want to coach you through your networking?
To get the thing going, I've got the word out to people I know. The first one I did was a freebie, so I had 12 people taking it as a freebie.
Test it out.
Test it out. Let me debug it.
Okay.
I had a managing director from Merrill Lynch in Boston. I had a real estate agency owner in New Hampshire. I had an ex-McKinsey person from New York City. I had a couple women business owners from Scranton, Pennsylvania. I had the head of marketing for a national law firm.
Okay.
So I think I had 12 people. That was every once a week for an hour, and it really went great. Nobody dropped out. At the end of the program, the marketing manager for the national law firm called me up and asked me if I could do a program for 10 or 12 or 13 of their associates in four different offices, New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, and Washington.
Go there.
No, to do it on Zoom.
Okay.
So I said, sure. I said, only it's not going to be a freebie.
Right.
I said,
you already did the freebie.
In the first 6 months, I'm going to charge people $200 a person to go through the four-part training program. I said, in the second half of the year, I'm going to charge $500 a person. So they can.
And it's a set curriculum.
Set curriculum that I put together.
Right.
It's,
yeah, I understand. Yeah. So you follow your curriculum. Maybe they have questions
or totally.
Whatever. But,
it's very interactive.
Okay.
Because I'm switching between having the slides on the computers
right.
and bringing up their faces.
Okay.
And the most I can comfortably handle is 15 people, including me.
Because of the platform and the faces and the slides and back and forth.
Right.
I understand.
Right.
Right.
So I can coach 14 people at a time, either from one organization or from the same organization, either multiple locations at that organization or
right.
the same. In June, I'm going to do a four-workshop program with this national law firm, coaching 14 of their younger associates in four of their offices. And I'm sure it's going to change lives. It's going to change careers.
Right. Now, is this something that you're doing for the general public? Like, if somebody goes to your website, networkallthetime.com, is there information on there where they can sign up for
Not yet. I'm going to
still
be
in the developmental stages.
I'm going to be putting
Is there a way on your website to register for your mailing list or your newsletter?
Yes,
or
yes, yes.
So if they register, then they'll receive information when this is rolling out.
Yeah.
So if anybody's listening out there, you want to interact with Jack, get on his list early, and then as this starts to roll out, you'll be one of the first people to participate in all this stuff.
And the real benefit, and I'm getting great reviews. One of the things I've done in the networking space is I've developed what I call the NQ survey, which is a way to assess a person's networking and relationship development skill level.
Okay.
So I get people to take it before the program and after the fourth workshop. And the result of the first group that I did, it was like a 45% improvement in their abilities as a result of taking my... They now understand how important this is, how to do it randomly, how to do it by targeting, how to network at events, how to network in groups, how to network online with LinkedIn.
Right.
So I get into all aspects of this.
You know, it's interesting and it's a little funny. It's like to us, it's intuitive.
Right.
You know, because of course I would do that. But a lot of people,
they don't
get it. And then, you know, I also think a lot of the online social stuff, people nowadays, especially teaching them, they don't realize that they can connect outside the meeting, too. You know, there's a new feature on LinkedIn where you can literally find the person standing next to you and link into them right there.
That's awesome.
A lot of people don't even have business cards anymore. They just want to link in and you get connected and they find out about stuff.
One of my advices to everybody is always have your business cards with you.
Right.
There was a woman, a graduate from the MIT Sloan School at the meeting last night. Really a brilliant woman.
No business
sitting
cards.
Next to me. I gave her my card. I said, could you have your card? She said, I don't have a card.
Right.
I said, you got to have a card.
I know.
How am I ever going to get back in touch with you?
Right. So if they don't have a card, you can go on LinkedIn right there and link into them. So at least you're connected that way.
Right.
Now, you also were getting into, you're working on a second book?
Yeah, but let me just, one other point about this group coaching program.
Good.
One of the reasons I did it is it now gives me the ability to coach worldwide.
Right.
And
not
I'm,
having to fly to Dubai or wherever you're going.
Or
right?
them flying in to
right.
see me.
Sure.
So I'm currently talking to a British company headquartered in London.
Okay.
I coached in person their New York staff last year. Now I'm talking about coaching their London staff remotely for $200 a person.
Right. Well, then it's inexpensive for them, and you don't have to fly over and put you up in a hotel for a week.
Right.
Sure.
So,
or even that, it's every 4 weeks. They have to fly in four times.
Right. So and the reason I have a week in between is because I suggest exercises that they practice in the weeks in between these sessions.
Homework.
So that, you know, I don't call it homework.
No, but it is. But you got to do the work.
You got to, right. You know. It's very interactive. I have them do an evaluation at the end of the program, and I'm getting absolutely great feedback.
Great.
Indispensable.
Well, sounds real promising.
What was your question?
You're working on a second book, you had told me.
I'm working on a second book. I'm about 80% done.
Okay.
The working title has Been There, Done That.
I think it's a great title.
Because I've been there and I've done that.
Right.
It's taking each part of my life and identifying the key lessons I learned that apply to businesses and entrepreneurs. Like, what did I learn in the horse racing business that applies to other business leaders? Could apply to Bill Gates as well as to an entrepreneur. What I learned in country music that every business leader needs to know is you have to have multiple revenue streams.
Right.
What I learned through Killing Extruders, one of the things I learned there, is it's important to pick the right partner. I picked the right partner.
Right. Sometimes we don't. A lot of people don't.
Right.
I think so. If anybody signs up either for our mailing list at vinelaw.com or your mailing list network all the time, they will get a notice when the book's released, right?
Right.
Okay. So that's a good way to stay in the loop.
So I take each stage of my life. What did I learn at Yale? What did I learn at McKinsey? What did I learn in the Army? One of the key lessons I learned in the horse racing industry that every entrepreneur and business leader, I think, should pay attention to is to trust your gut. Because in most businesses, if you make a decision and you sort of are queasy about it, you don't feel totally comfortable.
Right.
You can correct it somehow. Fire the wrong person or change the terms of the deal. In a horse racing business, if you make a judgment that you basically know could be not right, what you can wind up doing is killing the horse.
Right.
And at the racetrack, I had three horses get killed because basically I made a bad decision.
Really?
You know, that's irreversible.
Right. Devastating. It's costly financially. It's costly emotionally, right?
Yeah. So I learned from that to do a better job of trusting my gut.
Right.
So if I sort of see a business opportunity, like I see a business opportunity in coaching people on networking, you know, I'm going to pursue it because my gut tells me there's a need. Because I'm meeting so many people who don't have these skills.
Well, Jack, we've been doing this for about 2 hours. I think it's probably going to be a two-part episode. But I want to thank you for sharing all of your knowledge and your wisdom and your thoughts about what businesses you wouldn't do, you know, solely owned businesses, things about building revenue streams, networking. I encourage anybody listening to go to Jack's website, to get on his email list, to learn about what he's doing, to get the book, and maybe we'll buy a bunch of your copies and give some of them away when they come out of the new book.
That'd be great.
And we'll get this out to our mailing list. So thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it very much. We're friends, so we'll be having eggs and bacon together most months. And if anybody has any questions for Jack, what's your email? Jack@networkallthetime.com?
Yes.
Okay, and that'll also be in the show notes.
If you like our podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at beinlaw33@gmail.com. That's beinlaw33@gmail.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur has been written, directed, and produced by Mitchell Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about Mitchell and his practice, you can find him on social media or visit his website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.